Thank you very much. And thank you. I'd like to thank the President of the Faculty of History and Philosophy of Medicine for inviting me, as well as the Master and Wardens of this august society. I'm delighted to be here, and I hope that I can convey something of the really interesting aspects of the illustrations in scientific works that I've been working on over the years. So I'm a historian working on mainly 16th and 17th centuries with a particular interest in how images functioned in printed scientific books and how they helped to shape and disseminate scientific knowledge in the past. So after some general remarks about the period and studies of medicinal plants in the Renaissance, I'd like to discuss tonight the works of the English authors William Turner, John Gerard, if there is a picture in there. Ah, there it is. Okay, thank you. William Turner, John Gerard, Thomas Johnson, and John Parkinson. In this period, continental studies of medicinal plants were dominated by university-educated physicians who published in Latin. Turner, who had a medical degree, insisted that it was important to write in English so that surgeons and apothecaries who could not read Latin could use medicinal plants safely. Taking Turner's cue, Gerard, Johnson, and Parkinson also wrote in English. Yet these books on plants by all four were illustrated with images of continental origin. I shall be discussing the way they used these images to illustrate how they went about their study of plants. I'd like to begin with some preliminary remarks about the 16th and early 17th centuries, which falls within the period that historians call the Renaissance. It's well known as a period with three important characteristics. First, a reverence towards ancient Greece and Rome as the pinnacle of civilization. Secondly, it was also a period of flourishing artistic creativity. Thirdly, a period when it saw the diffusion of the printed book by movable type, invented by Gutenberg in 1450. All three aspects require further comment. It's often assumed that reverence for ancient authority was a hindrance to scientific progress. I suggest the contrary. The renewed interest in the works of ancient authorities in the period provided an important impetus for the study of nature. The Materia Medica by Dioscorides, the Greek physician from the first century AD, had been the central authority for the medicinal uses of naturally occurring material, namely flora, fauna, and minerals. Renewed interest in the classics in the period led to new editions of his work and spawned a commentary tradition that sought to revive ancient knowledge, particularly of medicinal plants. The preface of Materia Medica by Dioscorides famously advocated the importance of seeing for oneself, in Greek, autopsia. Dioscorides emphasized the importance to see plants not just once or twice, but frequently, so that one grasps the whole course of the life of a plant. The Tübingen professor, professor of medicine, Leonhard Fuchs, after whom the plant fuchsia is named, invoked the Greek word autopsia in his own commentary on the history of plants and sought to match Dioscorides' description with contemporary plants he knew. His portrait, holding a dainty plant, probably Germander Speedwell, can be interpreted as embodying this attitude of seeing for oneself. It was this first-hand experience, promoted and endorsed by the ancient authors, that some medical authors decided to pursue in this period. Secondly, it is worth heeding the warnings of art historians about what inferences we can make from the naturalistic styles of depiction that emerged in this period. Here are two drawings by Leonardo da Vinci. One to your left is so precisely rendered, modern botanists can identify it as a species of blackberry. But they have not been able to identify the other object to your right. It is a generic tree. Both drawings are skillfully and naturalistically rendered, but it does not always mean that the depicted objects really existed as such. We know of many cases, especially in anatomy, where Leonardo drew structures that could not have existed in reality. Perhaps the most famous case being this fanciful anatomical structure of the uterus of a pregnant female. So we have to be careful because naturalism does not always equate with the existence of an existing object, nor can naturalism be equated with direct observation. The advent of printing by movable type by Gutenberg was an important innovation in technology that was taken up by many scholars and writers. This technology was designed to replicate texts. There were two techniques of replicating images in this period, known at the time as relief and intaglio. Relief used woodblocks, cutting away the parts that should be white on the page and the parts left proud, being inked and printed to make the lines. Here's an example of a woodblock from Pier Andrea Mattioli's commentary on Dioscorides. Because woodblocks were in relief in the way that type fonts were, they could easily be fitted with the fonts and printed together with the text. Another technique of replicating images was intaglio, which printed the lines that were incised into copperplate. Inking the incised lines and printing these plates required extra pressure and a special press. Intaglio images then usually had to be inserted separately, or if inset with the text, the paper had to be put through two different presses. In the Galileo's text, you can see that the paper had to be put through the press twice. Okay. The pressure of the press making an impression of the entire plate can be seen. You can see the. I'm trying to think of how to do this. Well, you can see that you can see the. Right. You can see the plate mark almost overlapping with the text. I shouldn't move at all, in fact. Apologies. Now, if one used the woodcut, if one used a woodcut inset in a text, none of this problem occurs. From the printer's point of view, the addition of illustrations was an extra cost. Typically, printing a book illustrated with woodcuts cost 3 to 4 times more than printing a book of an equivalent size with only text. Copper engraving could cost 7 times more. The additional cost involved the material cost of woodblocks or copper plates, as well as labor of the specialized craftsmen to create replicated images. Normally, we do not know the names of the craftsmen involved in creating these images. They were rarely artists of Leonardo's caliber. The last page of Fuchs's History of Plants is most unusual in that it shows the craftsmen who were involved in making the woodcut. At the top right, Albrecht Meyer is shown here drawing a plant in a vase. Heinrich Fuhlmaurer traces the drawing onto a woodblock. And Veit Rudolf Speckling, at the bottom, is the cutter who cut the woodblocks that enabled the printing of the images. This was a common division of labour in creating woodcut images for printed books. There was a draftsman who made the original drawings, somebody who transferred the drawing onto a woodblock, and then a woodcutter who cut the woodblocks. The woodcutter could be paid 3 to 15 times more per image than the draftsman. It may be counterintuitive to us, but Speckle, not Meyer, was regarded as the creator of images. My point is that when we encounter early printed books with a large number of illustrations, we must appreciate the labour and financial investment that went into the material production of these books, as these affected the look and the content of the book also. Several studies of medicinal plants had been published since the late 15th century, and some had illustrations in them, though they tended to be schematic or diagrammatic, such as the Napellus and the Narcissus to your right, sorry, to your other right, to your left, okay, in the garden of health, okay, or generic jars to your right. It was Leonhard Fuchs's commentary on the history of plants, which I've already mentioned, that was the first book that assigned a different picture of a plant to each of the 511 plants he discussed. These were large woodcuts that took up a whole folio page, and Fuchs was justifiably proud of them. He described his pictures in Latin as absolutissima, meaning the most complete or the most perfect. The figures of the peony or the Chinese lanterns here show the root, flower, seed pods, and leaves whose shapes are fully and crisply rendered. You'll note that there is no defect in the plant compared to an earlier herbal by Otto Brunfels, which contained plants with broken branches and torn leaves. These are probably how the artist Hans Weiditz had actually found the particular specimen in nature, but individual defects were eliminated in Fuchs's pictures. Furthermore, there is hardly any hatching, as in the case of the figure of aloe here, and no shadow is cast. This was because Fuchs had planned his book to be coloured. Indeed, colouring effectively showed what was perfect or complete about his images. One bush of a plant could show variations, such as the three kinds of lamium to your left, or it was a composite of the different stages of a plant, bud, blossom, and fruits of the blackthorn in one bush here, for example. And here are some other examples. These composite images may well have been put together onto one page for economy of space and cost, but they also tally with the Aristotelian idea that scientific investigation requires a generalized object. Generalization was important for Fuchs because a medicinal property of a plant should be present in every instance of that species. He was not interested in a minute examination of an individual specimen found at a particular time or place. So pictures enabled such generalizations. Images could transcend the individual object by correcting defects and ignoring individual peculiarities, thereby creating a generalized object of scientific investigation. Images were central to Fuchs's task of establishing the identity of ancient medicinal plants. He compared features of medicinal plants Dioscorides had described in a text with features of a contemporary plant presented in a picture. By matching morphology, he established that they were the same plant. Sometimes he would then transfer the medicinal properties known from the contemporary plant onto Dioscorides' plant. So, for example, here, in this, with this picture, Fuchs identified Dioscorides' petasites with a plant known in his time as the pestilent foots, used for pestilential fevers. Dioscorides had identified no medicinal properties of the petasites, and Fuchs added to it the antipestilential property from the pestilence foots. By means of an image of a contemporary plant, Fuchs supplemented and improved on the classical knowledge of medicinal plants. On the other hand, New World plants were assimilated into the Dioscoridean scheme by attributing properties of known morphologically similar plants to the New World plant. Thus, Turkish corn, or maize to us, had the properties of wheat. Fuchs believed it was premature for him to attempt any systematization and arrange the plants in alphabetical order. His book was also nearly 900 pages with more than 500 large woodcuts. Such a hefty tome was for the upper end of the book-buying market. The cost of a bound copy of the Latin edition was equivalent to Fuchs's university salary for a month. Such books were expected to stay indoors. Fuchs's printer then issued a smaller octavo booklet with smaller woodcuts that were closely based on the larger ones. The woodcuts were cut by the same artist, Specklin. This book, Fuchs said, was designed for the specific purpose of being taken out into the fields, woods and meadows. It is these small images that had an astonishing reception. Preparing a new set of more than 500 woodcuts, albeit smaller sized, was a significant outlay, and Fuchs's printer promptly sold them on. They first appear to have been sold, held by a syndicate of publishers based in Paris, Jacques Gazot, Benoît Prévost, and the widow of Arnold Berkman, who had business interests in Cologne, London, and Antwerp. The first two publications in 1549 was an abridged translation of Fuchs's works, a work. In 1551, a third of the woodcuts were hired by an Antwerp printer, Stephen Meerdman, then working in London, for the first edition of William Turner's Herbal. Then the woodblocks were back with Jan van der Loo in Antwerp, who incrementally added to Fuchs's stock as he published a series of works by Rambert Dodoens, culminating in his Kreudebuch with over 700 woodcuts. Van der Loo seems to have had an agreement with the original Berkman firm as the latter printed the second and third editions of Turner's Herbal in 1562 and 68. Jan van der Loo died in 1563, and his son Hendrik took over and printed Henry Light's translation of Dodoens's Kreudebuch. The works of Turner and Light were the only English books on plants printed in this period that contained illustrations, and thus the bulk of their images derive directly from Fuchs's work. This was due to the business contacts of the London book trade. This pattern continued for English herbals. The publishers Bonham and John Norton for John Gerard's Herbal in 1597 borrowed more than 2,000 woodblocks from the Frankfurt printer Nicholas Bassias, who published an album of images of plants called the Acornis Plantarum, originally created for German herbal by Jakob Theodorus. And these images, in turn, were copies of Fuchs's and Dodoens's works. Thomas Johnson's revised edition of Gerard's Herbal was similarly illustrated with 2,791 woodblocks from the Plantin Press in Antwerp. The shortage of images or unwillingness of English printers to pay for new images had an effect on the first edition of William Turner's Herbal. The first edition contained about a third of Fuchs's woodblocks, restricted to the plants with Latin names starting with A to E. This may well have been because the publisher Meerdman had limited resources and could not rent out the full set. Indeed, it feels as if the printer was not familiar with setting woodblocks, as the images have registered rather faintly on the page. Though Turner excused himself for the brevity of this first volume, because he had dealt with only the plants he had actually seen, we know that there were plants he had seen earlier that were not included in this first edition. So the availability of illustrations is likely to have determined the content of his publication. In turn, this also suggests that Turner was not prepared to publish his work on plants without pictures to accompany his text. This may have something to do with Turner's initial difficulties in studying plants. In 1538, in trying to identify classical plants, Turner wrote, "For a long time among us, Narcissus has concealed itself under foreign names. There was no herb that gave me more trouble. For after I had seen its picture and outline and studied them as carefully as I could, no one could be found to show me the plant, much less tell me its English name. At last, when I was in Norfolk, a little girl, hardly 7 years old, met me as I was walking along the road. She was carrying in her right hand a bunch of white flowers. As soon as I saw them, I thought to myself, those are narcissi, for the description of them was still fresh in my mind, and I begged some from her. But when I inquired the name, no reply was forthcoming. So I asked the folk who lived in the neighbouring cottages and villages what was the name of the plant. They all answered that it was called Laus Tibi. I could get no other name from them. But when I got home, I learnt that asphodel was called by many people Laus Tibi. Then a little old man whose name is Warren Ash, a canon of Barnwell Priory and well skilled in herbalism, told me this plant was called French gillyflower. We must use this name until a better is found." Images guided Turner's research. The image of the narcissist Turner mentioned was most likely this one from Brunfels. By means of a printed image, Turner sought to match English plants with classical plants that had already been identified in Europe. But as Turner noted, finding a plant matching an image was one thing. Finding its English name was quite another. He soon decided that the narcissus comprised different plants with similar features, but at times an English name for a plant was elusive. In the case of Lysimachia, he made up an English name by translating the original Greek word, which meant loose strife. In the Oxford English Dictionary, Turner is credited with coining this name, and several others, such as buckwheat, cannabis, and carnation. Turner wrote his book in English to ensure that the plants could be used safely for medicinal purposes and provided an index of ailments and the names of plants that could be used as remedies. He defended the use of English for this task by pointing out that when Dioscorides or Galen wrote in Greek, their audience was Greek-speaking. His was an exercise in translation. And for Turner, finding the proper English name for a plant entailed first-hand knowledge. It was important for him to record the places where he had encountered them. As he said, and I quote, "Lest I should seem to be one of them which write of things which they never saw." He thus listed the places in England where he'd seen plants, and he also listed the individuals whose gardens he had visited or who had offered him help. During his two bouts of continental exile for religious reasons, he also met various people who had expert knowledge of plants, many of whom were practicing apothecaries. There isn't much evidence of Turner experimenting with medicinal properties of plants, but he does warn his readers of the dangerous effects of opium made of poppy juice, as he swallowed it once by mistake and nearly died. The third and last edition of Turner's Herbal, published in 1568, contained more than 500 woodcuts. These images again dictated what plants Turner discussed in what order. Clearly, Turner regarded images as crucial to his publication, and they were also a means to guide his research. Though Turner did not directly comment on the images accompanying his text, here is an oblique reference to the figure of a plant depicted in a woodcut. This kind of mandrag I have oft-times seen in England, and it is a herb that we call commonly mandrag. The roots which are counterfeited and made like puppets and mammets, which come to be sold in England in boxes with hair and such form as a man hath, are nothing else but foolish, vain trifles and not natural. Magical properties of the human-shaped mandrakes had disappeared from printed herbals since the beginning of the 16th century, but it appears that they were still peddled as dolls in Turner's time. Turner simply brushed aside this popular practice. I'd now like to move on to John Gerard's herbal, which was published 30 years later. It contained more than 2,000 woodcuts. Its sheer size made the book into a comprehensive book, a general history of plants to consult by his contemporaries. Gerard, a member of the Barber Surgeons Company, was known for his interest in plants, for the College of Physicians appointed him in 1586 as the curator of their garden, and he also became gardener to William Cecil, Lord Burghley. Many historians have condemned Gerard for his limited knowledge and his propensity to take credit that he did not deserve. In Charles Raven's memorable description, "It is hard to acquit him of all the sins of which a man of letters or of science can be guilty. He was a rogue." To some extent, this is valid, since Gerard could hardly be regarded as the sole author of the work. The text for the herbal was based on an English translation of Rambert Dodoyen's Peptardus. The translation was completed by one Robert Priest, who was, by 1597, dead. The woodblocks, as I mentioned earlier, were borrowed from Frankfurt. Gerard's task was to marry up Dodoyen's description with the images, but he used Lobelius's grouping in his Icornus that proceeded roughly by morphological similarities, such as seed leaves. Gerard tended to replicate the multiplied figures in Theodorus's album. For example, A woodcut was assigned to each of the milkwort, that was from the left to right, blue, red, white, purple, or dark coloured. And different stages of the same plant were illustrated with different images, saffron in flower and saffron without flower. Generalisation was not a primary concern here. Gerald also made some revisions to the identification in Theodorus's Acornus. One of the Gentians in Theodorus's album, that was called Clusius's Seventh Kind, Gerald changed to the spotted Gentian of Dr. Penny, namely Thomas Penny, the naturalist, because it was Penny who had supplied Clusius with the original specimen. This suggests a certain sense of patriotism in the contribution to knowledge about plants, and this may also account for Gerard's generally respectful tone in which he cites Turner. When it came to acknowledging the contribution of his acquaintance Matthias Lobelius, the Dutch naturalist who lived in England and was in the employ of Edward Lord Zouch, and who had been, in fact, drafted in by the printer to correct Gerard's mistakes, Gerard was less than generous. For example, Gerard proudly boasted that he was showing for the first time a true picture of ginger, placing it next to a feigned one, and he said, "The true form of picture hath not before this time been set forth by any that hath written, but the world hath been deceived by a counterfeit figure which the reverend and learned herborist Matthias Lobel did set forth in his observations." It was indeed Lobelius, it was indeed the case that the feigned picture of ginger was printed in Lobelius's earlier publication. But it was Lobelius himself who realised that the picture wasn't quite right and sent Gerard a corrected picture. Instead of simply replacing the erroneous picture with a correct one, Gerard juxtaposed the two, which suggests that he was trying to make a point about the superiority of his new true image over another image published by another author. The historian Deborah Harkness has pointed out how Gerard had a tendency to play down the contribution of a group of naturalists in London, mostly of Dutch origin. Interestingly, Gerald called the plants not indigenous to England as either a stranger or denizen meaning aliens who were granted citizenship with very limited rights, nevertheless. So, for example, the crown imperial, originally introduced from Constantinople, was a plant made denizens in our London gardens, and Gerald boastfully adds, "whereof I have plenty." The potato, by the way, the first printed image of the potato here, the potato, on the other hand, appears to have taken sufficient root in England to become almost a native plant. As he wrote, "it groweth naturally in America where it was first discovered. I have received roots hereof from Virginia, which grow and prosper in my garden as in their own native country." This is one of the few woodcuts that was added anew to the herbal. Of course, it helped that the potato was very useful. It was likewise a food as also a meat for pleasure, equaling goodness and wholesomeness unto the same, being either roasted in the ambers or boiled and eaten with oil, vinegar and pepper, or dressed any other way by the hand of some cunning in cookery. Clearly he liked his potatoes. Gerard recorded, in the way that Turner had done, the places where he had encountered a plant and the sources of his information. Compared to Turner's time, there were many more people with gardens of note in England. And although Gerard appears to have travelled extensively, quite a few of these references seem to derive from Turner or Lobelius, so we have to be careful in assessing the experiential basis of Gerard's work. Of particular note in this list for us this evening is, of course, the names Guillaume and Isaac Delorme. Guillaume Delorme, a reform minister who had fled France in 1572 and had settled in England to practice medicine, wrote a commendatory Latin verse that was prefixed to Gerard's book. By the time Gerard's herbal was published, Guillaume's son, Gideon, was an established apothecary in Brackfriars. Gideon's uncle, Isaac, a learned physician, was thanked by Gerard for having sent samples of a Gentian from Burgundy for the increase of his garden. The references to places and people function to show how Gerard was well-travelled and well-connected, and Gerard presented himself as knowledgeable, warning his readers of glib acceptance of images as objects. This was the case of the two pictures that he had from Theodorus, which he regarded as false. As he said, "Their pictures I could willingly have omitted in this history if the curious eye could elsewhere have found them drawn and described in our English tongue. But because I find them in none, I will lay them down here to the end that it may serve for excuse to others who shall come after, which list not to describe them, being condemned for feigned and adulterine, nakedly drawn only. The virtues and temperature are not to be spoken of, considering that we assuredly persuade ourselves that there are no such plants, but mere fictions and devices, as we term them, to give his friend a gudgeon. Gudgeon is a bait, and giving or having a gudgeon meant swallowing something credulously. Images of plants had been copied and recopied and were now proliferating such that whether they represented a real object or not had become a problem. Gerard used images to make a point about English contributions, foreign mistakes, and above all, about himself, growing those denizen crown imperials aplenty and expertly warning his readers that some depicted plants did not exist. The sheer number of images and plants discussed made this the most comprehensive book on plants available in English until its revised edition, printed in 1633. In the meantime, the Society of Apothecaries had been established in 1617, and Thomas Johnson became a free brother of the Society in 1628. For the 1633 edition of Gerard's Herbal, over 2,700 woodblocks were borrowed from the Planton firm at Antwerp. Johnson corrected Gerard's mismatches of images and names, as well as faulty descriptions, and also rationalised images when the plants in question were sufficiently similar. Indeed, it was very much enlarged and amended. Johnson placed a cross mark against images or descriptions to mark out carefully what he had added or corrected from Gerard's own description. This edition is often called the second or revised edition of Gerard's Herbal, but that would be an understatement, as Johnson brought the work up really to the standards of the scientific scholarship of Europe at the time. The structure of the work remained the same as in the 1597 edition. Like Gerard, Johnson acknowledged the gardens he visited, for example, that of John Tradescant, the king's gardener, and Sir John Tonstall, gentleman usher to the queen. Johnson also reported the places he had seen the plants and the sources of his information, but the nature of his trips and sources were quite different from Gerard's. Johnson's trips were trips specifically meant for the study and collection of plants, which he called simpling voyages, since plants were also known as medicinal simples. Such simpling trips had been a tradition of the Society of Apothecaries since 1620. This purple-flowered moneywort to your left, Johnson found in Durham in 1626, and the sea campion to your right was found on the grounds of the Isle of Thanet, opposite the town of Sandwich, on a simpling voyage Johnson made to Kent in 1632 with his fellow apothecaries. The trip was funded by the Society. On these trips, Johnson collected plants, kept a diary, jotted down descriptions, made some drawings, and gathered dry samples. He meticulously acknowledged the help of others, many of whom, as listed here in the right-hand column, were his fellow apothecaries. Given how his simple voyages were an important basis of his study, it is not surprising to see the book dedicated to this Society of Apothecaries. Compared to Gerard, Johnson's mastery of literature on medicinal plants was extensive and thorough, and he incorporated this literature to correct, supplement, and add new sections to Gerard's Herbal. These are all the authors that he has cited. And then on reading the works by Johann Theodor de Brie and Caspar Bohan, Johnson decided that one of Gerard's famed figures, the Flos Tigris, the tiger flower, was in fact a real flower, albeit a rare plant from Mexico. And this plant, of course, we now call Tigridia pavona. Johnson's method of work can be seen in a new section he added, and this is a section on the French or golden lungwort, which he classified as a subspecies of the hawksweed rather than the pulmonaria or lungwort, as Gerard had originally done. The first figure of the broad-leaved French or golden lungwort, Johnson explained, was first printed by Hieronymus Tragus in 1552. The second figure was first printed by Lobelius, who had given the figure the same Latin name as the first, but Johnson judged the plant to be a different variety because it represented a different plant. The third figure, Johnson identified from Basilius Bessler's work published in 1613, which he believed to be the same as the plant identified as a species of hawksweed by Clusius. Collating descriptions and pictures in past and recent literature, Johnson thus identified a group of subspecies of hawksweed. He then remarked that he had received samples of the first plant from his friend, John Goodyear, who found it in bloom on the 27th of May, 1631. The second plant was reported to him by another friend, William Coote. The last plant, though rare in England, he noted that because of the blackish hairiness of the stalks resembling the dust of coal, women who grew it in England in their gardens called it Grim the Collier. This neatly shows what was involved in studying medicinal plants for Johnson, a good mastery of past and present literature, the ability to collate and compare images, and assimilation of first-hand reports from friends and others. Johnson's work was a cumulative and collaborative effort as he worked with written sources, reports from others, and his own experience. He meticulously recorded his sources to emphasize this collaborative and cumulative nature of his work. Johnson's meticulous observational attitude is often buried as brief comments on Gerard, but it is captured well in this image of the banana, which happens to be its first printed picture. On the 10th of April, 1633, he was given a bunch of bananas by Dr. John Argent, president of the Royal College of Physicians, whose sister had married Gideon Delorme's brother, Paul. Johnson explained it was very soft and tender and tasted like a musk melon. And he explains this figure: "I have given you the figure of the whole branch with the fruit thereon, which I drew as soon as I received it, and it is marked with this figure 1. The figure 2 sheweth the shape on one particular fruit, with the lower side upwards. 3, the same cut through the middle, longways. 4, the same cut sideways. I could observe no seed in the fruit. It may be it was because it had been cut from the stock so long as before it came to maturity. This plant is found in many places of Asia, Africa, and America, especially in the hot regions. You may find frequent mention of it amongst the sea voyages of East and West Indies by the names of plantains or platanas or bananas." Johnson showed the banana on a branch, then one fruit in its entirety, and then cut through lengthwise and sideways. This is a comprehensive way to introduce an object from every angle. The image helps its reader visualize three-dimensionally an exotic, unknown object. So for Johnson, images functioned firstly as the foundation of a collaborative and cumulative effort to establish sound knowledge of medicinal plants, and secondly as a way to help readers visualize an unknown object. While Johnson's herbal contained quite a few exotic plants, he also noted the by then seemingly infinite variety of flowers in plants such as the tulip. And he wrote, "The varieties of these flowers are so infinite that it would both tire the writer and reader to recount them. Yet for that some are more in love with flowers than with plants in general, I have thought good to direct them where they may find somewhat more at large of this plant." Johnson's herbal was meant to be a general history of plants. To those that were more in love with flowers, he suggested the book The Terrestrial Paradise, published earlier in 1629 by his friend and a founding member of the society, John Parkinson. I shall now briefly turn to this book before concluding. Parkinson's Terrestrial Paradise discussed about 800 plants and included 108 woodblocks, each woodblock showing several plants. The woodblocks had been cut by Christoph Schweitzer, a Swiss refugee who had worked in London since the 1590s and had also cut illustrations for King James's Bible. This is, in fact, the first illustrated book on plants where the woodblocks had been prepared on British soil, albeit by Swiss craftsmen. Parkinson's plants were grouped into three gardens, the Garden of Pleasure, the Kitchen Garden, and the Orchard. The first part, the Plants for Pleasure, took up the bulk of the book. In showing and listing a large number of varieties of plants that were beautiful, and focusing on the patterns of the flowers rather than the entire stage or full figure of a plant, this book belonged to a new genre of publication on plants that emerged at the turn of the century on the continent, using intaglio prints. In 1608, Pierre Vallée published the Le Jardin du Roi, which was essentially an album of engravings of the flowers from King Henry IV's gardens. These pictures were to serve as patterns of embroidery for the Queen, Marie de Medici. The focus was on flowers and blooms. 4 years later, Emmanuel Swert, gardener to the Emperor Rudolf II, issued a similar album, adapting some of the images from Vallée's work. Swert was also a dealer in plants, so his engravings doubled up as a deluxe mail order catalogue. In the same year as Swert's album was published, Johann Theodor de Brie published the Florilegium, which was quickly followed by Crispin de Passe's Hortus Floridus. These were pictorial albums containing minimal text and focusing on the beauty of flowers from actual and imaginary gardens, presented to the reader in engravings. Parkinson's images resembled closely the engraved prints from these anthologies of pretty flowers. While the use of woodcut made the images appear less refined than those in engraving, it is clear that Parkinson was well aware of the visual developments on the continent and wished to keep up with them. It may come as a bit of a surprise that there was no indigenous tradition of illustrating medicinal plants in England until Parkinson's Terrestrial Paradise, and even then, the images were based on continental patterns. This may be explained by the cost of producing images that printers were not prepared to risk, presumably conditioned by the sense of a limited market in England for extensively illustrated studies of medicinal plants, and perhaps the limited availability of proficient local artists who were affordable by the printers. On the other hand, the fact that printers went to the trouble of borrowing woodblocks from the continent suggests that images were regarded as integral to the study of medicinal plants. They guided research into equivalent plants and names in England and formed a visual repository of medicinal plants that they shared with other European scholars and their predecessors. They could readily collate information with continental scholarship with what they found in England using these images. Not every exotic plant could become denizened in England, but the English herbals reminded their audience of the larger global natural world in which their experience could be placed, and Parkinson's book in particular demonstrated the infinite possibility of varieties that nature was capable of producing for pleasure. The challenge of producing illustrated works of plants became acute later in the 17th century, in England in particular, when intaglio prints became the standard for natural history publications. The valiant project to produce a universal history of plants using copperplate engravings bankrupted the Oxford Professor of Botany, Robert Morrison. But all of this surely is an indication of how important images had become for the study of medicinal plants. They enabled generalization, they guided research, they created a shared visual repository that enabled knowledge to become cumulative and collaborative. Thank you very much.